Oh, man. Oh, man. Oh, man. It's our second episode of 2019, and we are off to a great start because today we get to talk about one of my favorite places, one of the places that I find most fascinating in the world, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Welcome to Ridiculous History. My name is Ben.
My name is Noah. And Ben, you got me a pretty dope hat from there.
It's true. It's true. It's true, but I hope that I don't make our super producer, Casey Pegram, envious. It's just I saw the hat and thought of you, and it was like, it's not special if I get everybody the same hat.
Casey only wears that one hat that says movies.
It's true. It's a hat that says movies.
Yep.
Casey on the case. Yes, I did go to, I think we mentioned this on the show previously, in August of 2018, I spent some time in Korea. It was amazing. It was my first time. There's a lot of history there, and I was able to visit the DMZ. This is not an episode about the DMZ. This is more, I think, about the strange things that can happen when a country is under tyrannical authoritarian rule and is largely isolated from the rest of the world. We've talked about this before in various podcasts. There are some universal human desires. You know what I mean? People love to be entertained. People love to have delicious food. People love to feel influential in their circle and stuff. But when it comes to certain industries, it's very difficult for every single country to make its own domestic version of that industry. Like, it's really difficult to start a car industry. That's why there's a relatively small number of car companies that make cars for the rest of the world. It's also pretty difficult, or it was for some time, to start a film industry. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So today's story touches on so many things. It touches on the film industry. It takes place in North Korea. It touches on the U.S. military.
It touches on the idea of defecting to another country,
yes,
which I think is fascinating.
Have you ever thought of defecting? Were you one of those people who said sometime over the past few years, I'm going to go to Canada?
Is it called defecting?
That would just be, I think that would just be being a refugee.
Yeah.
Because to defect, at least in the way we're talking, you would have to be an active military
service member. Yeah. And here's a question too. Don't you have to kind of have like a real good reason to be a refugee or to seek asylum or something like that?
Right. Yeah. That your life is in danger for maybe your religious beliefs or maybe because of your sexual orientation, stuff like that.
That you're suffering under some kind of totalitarian regime.
Mm-hmm. Or if you are forced to return to the country, you will be murdered.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not, low be it unto us to get political on Ridiculous History, but starting to feel like that could be the case for our country one of these days.
So, in the minds of most people outside of the DPRK or North Korea, It's an enigmatic country. We, for a long time, didn't know a ton about what happened there. We just knew that it was ruled by the Kim family, right? And that the Kim family and their inner circle, the military cadre, ran the entire country, literally ran it. And people had to publicly adhere to a very rigid ideology, right? One that elevated members of the Kim family to the status of deities or demigods. It seems like a weird place to move to. I mean, anybody who's ever moved in their lives, any of us who have maybe relocated to a different town or a different state or a different country, can realize how disorienting that is. So imagine if you are U.S. Army Sergeant Charles Robert Jenkins. You don't speak Korean, right? You don't particularly enjoy being in the military, but you do love drinking.
You like knocking back a couple of cold ones with your buds.
Yeah.
A couple buds with buds.
Buds with buds. Well put. Approximately, in this case, 10. On January 4th of 1965, Sergeant Jenkins deserted his infantry company at the edge of the demilitarized zone, walked alone across a minefield, did not blow up, and defected to North Korea.
Yeah, man, the part that really got me there, among the multiple bonkers layers of the story, is walked drunkenly across a minefield.
Yeah, so after 10 beers, walked is probably a charitable description.
Yeah, which means he wasn't even being careful.
He did, like, drunk boxing parkour across the minefield.
Maybe it's one of those things, sort of like in the Inspector Gadget cartoons, where he just kind of bumbles his way and doesn't get killed by all these various pitfalls that could kill him, but by sheer luck, he happens to dodge every single one of them in some kind of physical comedy pratfall screwball kind of way. Are you picturing this?
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Whoa, but to do, folks, there's I missed the mine. You know,
people are still scouting for active mines in the DMZ today.
You were saying that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So the fact that he made it is a stroke of brilliant luck. What happens though when he does finally get into North Korea? Do they welcome him with open arms?
Well, not exactly. This is a theme that you see pop up, because we're going to talk about a handful of defectors. There weren't a lot, but there were a few, and they all shared a similar kind of result. They were forced to hole up in some pretty inhospitable housing and spend copious amounts of time studying the writings or the principles of Kim Il-sung, who is the patriarch of this North Korean dynasty.
Yeah, the first supreme leader of North Korea from its establishment in 1948 until he died in 1994. And he's also known as the Great Leader. He was declared the Eternal President of the Republic in 1998. So technically, he still holds a governmental position after his death. So Jenkins is forced to do homework, forced to study a Juche philosophy for 11 hours every day.
Tell me a little bit about Juche philosophy, Ben.
Juche, it's interesting because it's somewhat controversial. It's considered in the DPRK, Kim Il-sung's, his ideology, a revolutionary theory that was originally thought to be a variety of, like, Marxist, Leninist thought, while it incorporated these different ideas that were uniquely Korean in character. What eventually happened is that the North Korean government adopted this concept of Juche into a set of principles to justify policy decisions from the 1950s to today. It's got an emphasis on agricultural independence, lack of international dependencies, you know what I mean? It's controversial, however, because this Korean-style socialism, the thing that it is on paper rarely makes it to what happens on the ground, you know what I mean? It's better in theory than it is in practice.
Absolutely.
So a lot of the stuff, and this might just be an issue of translation, a lot of the stuff in English is very, very dry and very process-oriented. It's like a dusty philosophical tome and somewhat redundant. And Jenkins has to read this for almost 12 hours every day until he can recite the primary principles of Juche in Korean.
That's right. And then he wasn't even offered a choice at this point. He was forced to become a North Korean citizen and was put to work as an English translator and teacher. And he also, you're going to hear about this part a little later, along with some of these other folks, was an actor. But every move he made, as the police would say, every move you make, every step you take, Supreme Leader is watching you.
Right.
I'm paraphrasing here a little bit.
I thought that was well done.
The words of Sting.
Mm-hmm. He was also forced to marry a Japanese citizen who had been kidnapped by North Korea. Her name was Hitomi Soga. She was kidnapped in 1978 to be a slave teacher of Japanese language and customs for North Korean spies. The strange thing about this is that Jenkins, as you mentioned, Noel, Jenkins became an actor, but he became an actor in propaganda films. So it turns out that Jenkins found his strange career in propaganda films because the ruler, the son of Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, was a huge film buff. like huge, Casey, more of a film buff than any of our mutual friends.
Yeah, he has apparently like just a huge collection of physical media.
And I read that it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 pieces.
Yeah.
And most of them are bootleg because right. they did not have a trade relationship with the United States. So they would have had to be smuggled or some kind of weird bootleg versions.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And it's strange because North Korea actually does have a thriving animation industry now. And it's pretty solid stuff. But back then they wanted to make their own uniquely North Korean feature films. And one of the first things they did when they started making feature films is they started making war stories, inspirational, nationalistic narratives.
Propaganda.
Right, propaganda. Mm-hmm. And for that, they needed convincing enemies. They needed someone to be depicted as agents of chaos from the American side. And they said, oh, look, we've got this guy. We've got this Sergeant Jenkins here, and then they also realized that they had a couple of other defectors.
That's right. We have a guy by the name of Larry Abshire who crossed the DMZ on May 28th at 19 years old. Then we have Private James Joseph Dresnok who followed Abshire's lead. I think it was 3 months later. And who else do we have, Ben?
Then we also have Joseph White, who slipped into North Korea in 1982. And we have Jerry Parrish, who left for North Korea in 1963. These men gave different explanations for their motivation, right? There were some who said they were sold on the communist lifestyle. Some just wanted to get away from their problems in the West. And some just didn't know what they were doing. You know what I mean? And it's not a situation you could undo easily.
Yeah, Jerry Parrish didn't really give too many details other than to say that if he ever returned home, mm-hmm. his father-in-law would kill him. So I guess a reasonable solution to that is to, you know, defect from your country.
Right. He seemed like he had a legitimate fear of his life.
Which he wanted to go off the grid.
Goes back to the UN idea of pleading asylum or refugee status.
Yeah, but this is not the same as that, right? I mean, this is very much like I am abandoning my country. I am leaving my post, mm-hmm. which would, you know, result in like court-martial or like treason charges, I would think, mm-hmm. wouldn't you?
Yeah, it would. And this will bring us back to Charles Jenkins in a little bit. But we've got to tell you, these guys, when they were cast in these propaganda films, they were playing evil Americans. And one thing that was amazing about this is over time, after several films, they became local celebrities North Korea.
Yeah, because it's a very insular country. So, I mean, they didn't really have that much access to anything other than what was produced by the government.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have been absolutely front and center, especially considering that they were like the only Americans around.
Yeah.
So, you know, they would have made an impression.
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have to say, without impinging their character too much, none of these guys who defected from the U.S. Army were paragons of military virtue. You know what I mean? There was one guy, Abshire, that we mentioned, who was notorious for being a pothead. He got caught multiple times getting high.
Yeah. No shade on potheads.
Sure.
But I mean, you don't do it willy-nilly while you're on your post.
While you're at your job.
Yeah, definitely
you
not.
You know, unless your job is like you work for High Times or something.
Sure.
If that's still around. Or Vice Magazine. It's true.
It is true.
So these guys are quickly involved in the most surreal sort of life. They're not just movie stars, right? They're also icons that can be used to antagonize other members of the U.S. military or South Korean military. They were Abshire and Dresnok, and then later Parrish and Jenkins were featured in propaganda magazines. They had put out a magazine called Fortune's Favorites that depicted the Americans smiling ear to ear, marveling at the joyous benefits of life of the DPRK. And they had things, they had different segments or columns. One was called Letters from Abshire and Dresnok, titled To the American Soldiers South of the DMZ. And we've got a quick quotation here. Dear old fellow friends, enjoying warm welcome from the North Korean people, I put off the disgusting GI uniform and visited Pyongyang and other cities and villages to tell the truth, the people in North Korea are enjoying freedom and happiness inaccessible to the working people of the United States. Now, please, don't be a victim for the Wall Street, but fight for your withdrawal from South Korea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I mean, it sure sounds like, we mentioned this a little bit, but all of these gentlemen experienced a very similar degree of indoctrination.
Yes.
And they were forced to, like, they weren't fed properly. They were basically just forced to memorize this these core principles. And I don't know, enough time isolated and alone. And I think weren't some of them forced to live together and kind of pitted against each other in some kind of weird Hunger Games-y kind of scenario?
Yeah, Abshir and Parrish had to live together. Jenkins and Dresnok also had to share a home while they were teaching English at a military academy. And that excerpt I just read is clearly not written by these guys. It's not written by Dresden.
But your accent was so convincing, Ben.
Thank you. That's because he did have an accent. He still, I think, up to until his death, had a trace of his rural North Carolinian accent. But what we see when we look at the way North Korea treated these defectors is very similar to what we see when people are indoctrinated in cults. One of the big things that every cult does is to bombard people with information. It can be senseless. It can have its own internal logic. The point is to remove the possibility of asking questions, just make people memorize and recite things. And then what's very clever about putting them in homes and kind of pitting them against each other is it makes it much more likely for them to accept their forced marriages. Because when they were forced to marry other kidnapped people, often from Japan or something, it was entirely assumed by the government that these couples would reproduce, and then they could use the quote-unquote, this is not a phrase we're using, they could use the quote-unquote ethnically ambiguous children as spies. They could blend in, you know what I mean?
Absolutely, Ben. And I think it's interesting that you talk about the kidnapping aspect of this, because this is a really interesting gray area to me, kind of, where it's like they are submitting themselves to this. They made the choice, either drunkenly or with some ideological kind of bent, to cross that DMZ into this other country and, you know, toss off their the trappings of being an American. But they also probably didn't fully know what they were signing up for. And then they were basically thrown into this indoctrination factory, you know, and forced to live in subhuman conditions and turned into something that they were not when they made that choice. So, you know what I mean? It's like sort of like a weird, it's almost like a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And some, like in the case of James Dresnok, he died happily in North Korea in 2016. He was unrepentant. He professed support for communism. He was the last living American defector in North Korea. He's also got the nickname Comrade Joe in DPRK because, again, he's a celebrity. He was featured in a film called Crossing the Line at South Korea's Busan International Film Festival. And he says he feels at home in the film. He never regretted going to Korea. He seems very sincere about it. He says his life is better because he defected. And by North Korean standards, his life was pretty good. But you can tell the lack of medical and dental care took a toll on him. Like, his front teeth are missing.
Right.
Is that something that he acquired from North Korea, like from violence, or did they just fall out? He also had a heavy, heavy drinking and smoking habit. Mm. So it took a toll on him.
Well, get this, Ben. That perspective is one side of the coin. Our boy Charles Robert Jenkins, who was kind of he sort of spearheaded this whole thing, you could say, he actually escaped or was able to leave in 2004. Quite recently.
To visit his mother.
That's right. And he had some slightly less sympathetic words or kind words to characterize the experience of these four men, if I may.
Oh, please.
Quote, "We were all young, dumb soldiers from poor backgrounds. I had a pretty good military record, while the other three were pretty much total f-ups as soldiers. The three of them, also like me, walked across the DMZ without really thinking about the huge consequences of what they were doing and without understanding what North Korea was really like. They were trapped there in North Korea. All of them quickly grew to hate the country and would have left in a second if they could have. what a sorry-ass little foursome we were. So, according to Jenkins, any expression to the contrary from any of these guys who he was intimately familiar with was either forced or a product of some kind of brainwashing.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Also, North Korea is a very homogenous, racist environment. I believe it was Jenkins who says that he had only once been in the same room with the great leader Kim Il-sung, and Kim snorted disapproval at Jenkins' Korean clothing and ordered him and all other Westerners to never again sully Korean clothing, so he wore a suit and tie afterwards. It's great detail on that story from The Atlantic. There's an article from 2013 called The U.S. Soldier Who Defected to North Korea by Graham Wood. I'd highly recommend checking that out. But as you said, Noel, Jenkins is a little bit different because after he spent nearly 40 years in North Korea, he got out. When he left North Korea in 2004, he was 64 years old. The army threw him in the stockade for 24 days. He got a dishonorable discharge. And then eventually, he and his wife moved to Japan, where he sold crackers.
Yep. Full circle? No, not really.
Not really.
No.
It's weird, though, because he's still sort of an exotic icon, right? First in North Korea, now in Japan. Apparently, and did you hear this? In Japanese culture, he and Hitomi Soga's story about how they met and how they married and you know, became a family is considered one of the great modern romances.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to see this is such a bonkers story. Wouldn't this make a fun, like, kind of screwball, Coen Brothers-y
film?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, like, these two people find love under these really weird 1984-esque Big Brother Orwellian conditions, and then they stick together, and they eventually win their freedom. Apparently, when people walk into the shop, they start whispering to each other, and they stare at Jenkins until he caves and says, "All right, come on, you can take a picture with me." Photo is one of the only words he knows in Japanese.
Interesting.
There's another soldier who was thought to have possibly defected to North Korea, a guy named Roy Chung. His story is pretty controversial. He was born in South Korea as Chung Ryu, and he moved to the U.S. with his parents in 73. He joined the army when he needed college money. And here's the strange thing, Noel. He was nowhere near Korea when he disappeared. In 1979, he vanished from his unit in Germany, and 3 months later, the North Korean state radio announced that he had defected. The Pentagon and State Department say that's probably true, but his parents are still convinced he was kidnapped.
Wow.
No one knows what happened to him. He just disappeared.
Well, Ben, this has been a pretty incredible ride. I think we have some pretty neat other kind of side stories about some other interesting film-related North Korean tales that we could probably wrap with if you wanted to. I don't know that there's much more to say about these particular defectors.
Well, nothing that's been made public yet, right? The last defector that you will hear brought up in these sorts of lists is a guy named Joseph White, who's considered the sixth and possibly final U.S. soldier to defect to the DPRK. He came aboard on August 28th, 1982. He shot a lock off a gate at the Korean DMZ and started walking through the minefields. His mom didn't believe it, first off. She said he loved this country, loved that uniform and everything about it. He was nothing but a gung-ho army and gung-ho Reagan guy. But back at his barracks, investigators found all these pro-North Korean leaflets and propaganda. His buddies were dumbfounded, and no one heard of him until 1986, when White's parents got a letter from someone in North Korea who said that they were friends with the soldier and that he had drowned in a river while enjoying a leisure time outing. So don't know what happened to him. We do know that North Korea produced a number of propaganda films, not just Unsung Heroes, not just that 1978 banger.
Mm-mm.
We have a little bit of a list. What really stuck out to you on this list of propaganda films?
Well, maybe this isn't necessarily a propaganda film, but I think this is a fantastic story that apparently Kim Jong-il had some directors, very popular North Korean film directors who escaped to Hong Kong, kidnapped and brought back to North Korea and forced to make a ripoff of Godzilla.
Yes.
Paul Gasari. And the plot of this is incomprehensible to me. But I love it. There must be some cultural thing that I'm missing here. But apparently the story, it's the story of a small doll made of rice that becomes a mythical creature and helps the peasants, the proletariat, overthrow a monarchy that is corrupting their land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting that they would cast it from the perspective of the proletariat, right? Like the peasants doing an uprising, kind of, right? Like that. How does that serve the regime?
You know, that's a complex question.
That's fair.
That's a complex question. It's a matter of perspective and zeitgeist, isn't it? But you're right. Kim Jong-il was so interested in film that he, do we mention his book on the art of the cinema?
No.
So he describes his tactics of using movies as educational tools to spread his ideals to the nation, sort of the way Saddam Hussein wrote those historical fiction romance novels, which is also really weird.
It's true. And I believe if you want to get a little bit deeper dive into that, you can check out our pal Robert Evans' show, Behind the Bastards, where he does an episode specifically on those romance novels of Saddam Hussein.
I did. Yeah, that's true. And we'll probably have Robert on the show again sometime soon, I think.
I would love that.
So Kim Jong-il's would-be film industry was entirely fueled by the kidnapping of directors, actors, other artists from South Korea, from Japan, these various places. It seems like he didn't understand that it was wrong to kidnap people. He just thought that was the way you hired people.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's also Seoul's protests. There's Eternal Comrades, which is it's based on this this situation in 1946. A terrorist group tried to kill Kim Il-sung. A Soviet officer named Yakov Nevchenko saw the grenade and sacrificed himself by throwing his body on top of it, and it saved Kim Jong-il's life. And then this guy, the Russian Nevchenko, had a large book strapped to the front of his chest as a kind of body armor. It saved his life too. And then that made him, I think, the first Russian to receive the title of North Korean National Hero. And Eternal Comrades reenacts the events of that day.
Genius.
Is it?
Well, you know, in terms of it being just wild.
Yeah, and it's weird because you can see clips of these on YouTube and if you want to watch them, but it's very difficult to find the full copy of these in entirely English forms. Or at least I looked around a little. I was having a tough time. So if you find a clip of a good North Korean propaganda film, send it our way. Post it on Ridiculous Historians. And I have a surprise for you, Noel.
Give it to me, Ben.
So we know that the Kim dynasty is able to exert tremendous influence on the country. And that means that, let's say, if Kim Jong-il really wants a movie industry, then he can make the entire country help support him in this endeavor, right?
Oh, of course, he can do whatever he wants.
There's a new leader in town, Kim Jong-un, and Kim Jong-un has an obsession of his own. In fact, just recently, North Korea officially urged all of its citizens to make the country a basketball powerhouse. North Korean state media has declared basketball to be a critical part of the state's ideology and called on all workers and soldiers to turn the nation into a global leader in the sport of basketball.
Interesting.
It's no coincidence, perhaps, that Kim Jong-un is himself a huge fan of basketball, a situation so surreal that it led to Dennis Rodman essentially functioning as a diplomat. Do you remember that when it popped up in the news?
Very, very much so. I believe, isn't there a documentary or at least a short about Dennis Rodman's behavior and the way he went to Korea? I think there is.
Yes, that's correct. So far, I think as of December 2018, he's paid 5 visits to the capital of North Korea and even serenaded Kim Jong-un with a rendition of Happy Birthday during a basketball game. So Am I saying that if you were good at basketball, watch out because you might be kidnapped by North Korea? No.
But you're not saying it.
I'm not saying it is the point.
Yeah, yeah.
So let us know. Look, North Korea is a fascinating country. Luckily, it's much less isolated now due to the rise of technology, you know, the increasing access people have to the internet through mobile phones and things like that. There are gross and ongoing human rights abuses in the country, and in many ways, it is a black hole. And much of what we know about North Korea comes from people who have left the country, who have defected for one reason or another. Today's episode examined the very strange story of the people who went in the other direction. Would you ever do it? Casey, Noel, would you ever defect to a distant, maybe not U.S.-friendly country if it meant you could live as a king?
Why not?
You know, YOLO.
All right. Well, tell us which country we should defect to. Thank you so much for tuning in. We would like to hear your North Korea facts, the strange trivia that you have found about it. You can share that with us and your fellow listeners on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We also recommend Ridiculous Historians, our community page, which is just chock full of ridiculous, scrumptious history.
Chock-a-block.
It's
history nuggets is what I like to call them.
There we go. It's chock full of good old history nuggets.
Big thanks to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Big thanks to Alex Williams, who composed our theme.
And of course, thanks to Gabe, our research associate. And you know what? As we always say, thanks to you, Noel.
Ben, I appreciate that from the bottom of my heart. And I whip that right across this net. This non-existent net, this imaginary net that's in the middle of our podcasting table, right back at you, buddy.
Man, if we didn't spend so much money on that Quister grandfather clock, we could have an actual net. We could be playing ping pong while we're doing the show.
That's a lot of multitasking, Ben.
That's a lot of multitasking. I know. I have to learn how to work this puppet before tonight, so I got to get out of here.
You were really working that puppet a little while ago, weren't you, Ben?
We'll post it somewhere on social, but we do actually have a puppet in the studio with us today.
Yeah, and it's weird. When you see a puppet that does not benefiting from the hand of the puppeteer, it's just kind of slumped over in a chair. It's a little bit unnerving.
But maybe we'll even make a propaganda video for Ridiculous History with this puppet. Maybe we can kidnap other podcasters to get them to help us out. This is getting crazy. We should probably just call it a day.
I agree. See you next time, folks.